Hi, my name is Craig Sebenick. I am currently a what I call an infrastructure engineer. The title doesn't really matter that much. It's essentially SRE at a small startup called Matterport. This talk is about implementing SRE at that said small company. I spent almost 4 years at LinkedIn as an SRE while LinkedIn was transitioning from what they called application operations, more of a classic operations role, into SRE. And I learned a lot of things and how to make that happen. So what does this talk answer? Does SRE work at the startup? And the short answer is yes. None of what I'm going to say is rocket science or brain surgery. None of it is all that complicated. Most of it is about priority, knowing which things to attack first, and then just starting to attack them. So to give you a little history about what happened at LinkedIn, what I saw that really helped me form the ideas that I'm currently implementing, let's go back in time. So I joined LinkedIn in late 2010. At that point, there was a central NOC. That NOC watched the site, literally hundreds, thousands of graphs that they would watch Monday through Friday. What this meant is that a pager, specifically was BlackBerry, it doesn't really matter, but it was a physical device that was handed off Friday afternoon, everybody had to carry it. There was a central team, again, it was called Applications Operations at the time, and then we rebranded, which I'll touch on in a few minutes, to SRE a little bit later. Now, one note about this pager, it would go off constantly. And I mean constantly, literally every 2 to 4 minutes, all weekend long. There are stories about people who preceded me where they trained their significant others to watch the pager so they could sleep for 4 hours, and then they would swap. As a note, a side note, there were a couple other operations teams that were all kind of peers with SRE or AppOps. And that was teams that kind of handled operating systems and down, which include like Rack and Stack report into them. They managed the data centers, et cetera, network admin, DBAs, et cetera. So the point is there were several operations groups. Application operations was just one of them. Also, another side note, I was actually out of tech for a couple of years. So LinkedIn was kind of my first introduction into DevOps and the new ideas. Many years before that, I was doing sysadmin at Network Appliance. I was there for many, many, many years, way too many. So there were a lot of ideas that were really, really new to me, even though I've been in the industry for quite a while. So next, let's talk about the release process at LinkedIn in early days. I'm sure many of this is going to sound familiar to you if you've been at a company that's transitioned from a more classic centralized team to something more distributed. So there were large releases every other week. It was extremely complex. There were lots of dependencies. There were so many dependencies they would actually have to cap the number of changes they would make at any one release cycle. The releases were always done after hours. It took many hours. The releases would often start about 6 or 7 at night. It was not totally unusual, but it was once in a while, release would go into 2 or 3 in the morning. There was a complicated release branching scheme where they would create a branch for what they wanted to release to, and then future branches as well. Again, every other week, for nomenclature, they would name it the two-digit year and the week. So in early 2011, it would be 1108, and then 1110, 1112, et cetera. And what they had was an auto-merging function. So if you checked into the one for this week, you obviously want that code in every future release as well. But what happens if you want to check something in, say, a month from now? Well, you check in that branch. Yes, merge conflicts all over the place. To manage this whole complicated situation, there was a central team called the release team that handled all the dependencies, knew which thing had to go before which other, which thing could be rolled back, which could not, who to call, et cetera. Lastly, there was a centralized service for all configuration information. The developers did not have access to this. Only SRE, AppOps, release team, a few teams had access to it. So developers could not actually see the differences in their configuration between the staging environments and production. So then we started to change things. As I mentioned, it was originally called Application Operations. We rebranded it to SRE. Specifically Bruno, the VP, rebranded it to SRE. That name change is actually important. Names do matter. And in this case, it signified to the rest of the company that we're making a change. The SRE team was broken up into dev-specific teams. So there were essentially four to six different development teams, and there was an SRE team assigned to each one. Over time, the centralized SRE team was broken up such that each of these SRE dev teams would sit with their actual development teams. This became even more apparent right before I left, roughly 2 years ago, when they opened up a large facility in the city. There was a bunch of shuffling of people so that the people who would work with the development team that actually sat in San Francisco, that SRE team was not sitting in, say, half the SRE team was not sitting in Sunnyvale or in Mountain View. This also meant that we worked much closer with a subset of developers. This meant from the SRE side, it was much easier for me to ask questions, hey, how does this thing work? Can you explain why this thing doesn't always work the way I expect it to? So the communication actually went both ways, which was fantastic. Another small side note, again, because I was out of tech for a while, there were a lot of things that were relatively new to me. Personally, I was relatively opposed to this idea of breaking it up. In retrospect, it absolutely works. The centralized team definitely has all kinds of problems, and the problems you have with communication within the SRE team can be addressed. We implemented Salt, SaltStack, as our automation platform, which led to us doing a lot more coding. There was still a centralized tools team that did a lot of coding, and we used a lot of their libraries, but we also developed our own tools kind of tangential to what they were doing. And then much later, there were actually SRE teams for individual products, as an example, internal products. As an example, LinkedIn's a big Jira, Atlassian shop. So they ran into some problems with trying to scale out Jira, and there was an SRE team that was eventually formed to help with problems like that. At the same time, this wasn't necessarily related to SRE, but at the same time, all these problems with the release process were being addressed. And so they implemented more and more DevOps. Devs were given a lot more access to things. For example, the centralized configuration system was completely changed. This whole releasing strategy was changed to a centralized branch model. Essentially, you check it in, it's got to be ready for prod. None of this, this branch and this branch can go, but not these other five, because those features are actually ready. If it's checked in, it's ready to go. End of story. As I mentioned, the configuration data was essentially broken up into different repos that they had access to, and the developers could make changes themselves. There were some exceptions. There were secrets that were encrypted that they didn't have access to the keys. They could see the encrypted values, but they couldn't see the plain text ones. And where this does help, they could at least see that this same value is used in these three environments. The actual text of the value doesn't really matter. They just know that if it works here, it should work here and here as well. There were several levels of testing. There was pre-commit. If they failed that, LinkedIn's a big Java shop, or at least used to be. And if it can't compile, for example, there's no reason to check it in. And then there was what they call pre-commit short and pre-commit long. What they would do is they would break up their tests into things that would run on the order of 5 minutes or less, and then 20 minutes or less. And the idea is, if you needed to roll something back, if you had to group 5 minutes worth of changes, that's not so bad. If you have to group an hour's worth of changes, that's a lot of people that can be affected by one bad commit. So by having these multiple buckets on which tests could then run and the whole collection would fail, meant that if you could had a simple test, you can just run in PCS, so the post-commit short, so that you weren't going to affect a large number of people, a large number of commits. Eventually, developers were able to deploy all the way to production. There was a canary that they rolled to, then the entire cluster. One of the things that also helped was A-B testing. Everything was wrapped in A-B testing. When I say everything, I mean almost everything. But everything was wrapped in an A-B test, which meant that they could roll it out to the canary, and there should be zero change from any other applications perspective, either upstream or downstream. They could verify that, yes, it's backwards compatible. They roll it out. They start rolling up the A-B test, and things start breaking. Crap, roll back down, et cetera. Also, devs were involved in on-call. This was not across the board. Different development teams embraced this more than others. Also, more self-service. If you've heard any LinkedIn talks, they've often talked about Ingraphs, which is their internal graphing system. All the dashboards are in YAML, which means every developer, product manager, anybody throughout the company can create a dashboard that's interesting to them. There were automated code metrics. So the developers didn't have to go to a central team to say, hey, I need these metrics emitted, captured, and graphed. They could just annotate their Java code. It would go into Kafka, and there were other systems on the other end that would just read those Kafka streams and just pump it into Ingraphs and create a whole shit ton of graphs. There were no limits on the number of metrics sent. This was a small challenge. There were some teams who liked metrics a lot, and they would use a fair amount of all this bandwidth and resources. This was an ongoing challenge, and you just have to work with the dev teams to explain to them that, hey, you realize you're using your one app out of, keep in mind, LinkedIn was roughly 300 to 400 applications at this point. One app is consuming 5% of all metric resources is pretty extreme. And then this system was expanded to do self-service alerts as well. So why am I mentioning all this? Why is this all important? The point is that LinkedIn was not small when I joined. It was several hundred employees. It was a well-established company in 2010. A lot of people were using it. We were well over 100 million members. It was a big deal to make this change. One of the big things that really pushed us forward is management support. If you want to make a change like this, everybody has to be on board, because there will be problems. There will be roadblocks. If a VP in, for example, engineering, is not on board with this, he will sidestep the entire process. Fortunately, all of management was on board. Bruno did a fantastic job on getting all the senior executives to say, yes, this is really the future we need to head to. There were a lot of things that changed that allowed LinkedIn to grow to where it is today. Self-service is extremely important. If you have a metrics, as a great example, that was a team I was on right before I left. If you have something where you have to have a person or a set of people approve it, make this change, you're always going to have resource constraints. So providing self-service is extremely important, but it's not without their challenges. Again, the one application out of 400 that consumes 5% of all metric resources is a bit of an issue you have to address. Lastly, if LinkedIn can do it at this size, your startup can do it, I guarantee it. Next is Matterport, the startup I joined, and what happened when I joined? Yeah, it was a lot of fun. So exactly what was it like? Well, it was very kind of classic startup. There was a single developer that took on all the operations work. He was the only one that knew the entire stack. He wrote the tooling as needed to tie different applications together. Not all of these tools were checked in. There were often small changes made live on production machines, so it was actually different between, say, the staging environment and production. He had several Snowflake servers. This one is always just a little bit different. Yes, you can run this automation, but don't forget to run these other 10 things, manually change these other 10 things as well. There were no metrics to speak of, and there was limited monitoring. Releases, the same person ran all of the releases. There were alpha beta environments, so all the code was in alpha, all the new code was in beta, and then they would swap the load balancer to point to alpha to beta. What does this mean? Well, connections don't drain instantaneously, so all old edits would continue to go to some old connections would continue to go to the old code base, to the old database. Yes, they had different databases as well. And so SQL was manually copied from one database to another. There was little or no communication. Oh, we had a release last night, FYI. This was a hard down. We put up a maintenance page. Things always ran late. It was always scheduled for late at night. Yes, all this sounds very familiar. This is very much the same as LinkedIn early days. Like I said, hand edits made the prod. This is not atypical. I hear these kind of stories from startups all the time. engineers want the code not to deploy. This is not their fault. So just be aware. Go in with your eyes open and don't blame them. Just try and fix it. Ops work happens organically. People come in and they have an interest. They've done it before and they've moved into more of a development role, however it happens, but it does kind of naturally happen over time, which means all kinds of weird things are introduced and never quite gotten rid of. And this was just a challenge I was looking for. So what do I do first? Prioritize, figure out what are the biggest problems. And this isn't strictly a technical thing. This is also a business proposition as well. Simplify, there were, like I said, there were a lot of things where decisions were made, things were changed, and maybe they were half implemented, maybe they were partially moved to a new application. That made it very confusing to figure out which part of the automation was deploying this piece of code, which was managing this config. You wanted to change this config, where exactly do you do that? Simplify. Simplify helps then to empower other developers to get involved, because if they can't understand it either, they are likely not going to make a PR to fix it. Lots of Jira tickets. This was addressed, I think, last night. Just make tickets of things, or make a list, whatever works for you, of things you want to go back and fix eventually. Communication. Tell people so they're not surprised. Blindsiding your developers is just bad. Like I said, get management buy-in. If everybody's on board, when you do have these problems, when you do have these roadblocks, we can all kind of move together towards a solution. Lastly, at an all-hands meeting, I said, we all collectively own the site. This might sound like an obvious thing, but when you're used to a central team, again, person, that handles production, he's the only one that gets pages, he's the only one that deploys, management says, oh, he is the one I talk to when there's a problem. Changing that culture is extremely tough. And telling somebody from accounting that they own the site may sound a little odd, but it provides this culture of everybody owns a site, not just development. If anybody's saw Mikey Dickerson's presentation, either here or he's presented at Lisa, he's presented several places, he has presented this thing called the hierarchy of reliability. There are certain things that are really important from essentially the bottom on up. There was another talk that said there's even another level below that, which is food and sleep. So what are my hierarchy of needs? What did I address? Again, based on not just technical, but also business needs. Metrics monitoring is first. The VP of operations, well before I left LinkedIn, used to say you can't fix what you can't measure. Reproducible builds, manually changing things in production means that you have no idea if this server, which is supposed to be identical to these other four, is really the same or not. Stable, predictable releases, knowing that, hey, next week we are going to release Wednesday at 8 a.m., end of story. Oh, we don't have anything to release? Okay, we'll skip that one. Then it's the next Wednesday or the next Wednesday. Or it's the first Wednesday of every month, whatever happens to work for you. More communication and documentation. The idea of self-service, again, if they can't understand what's going on, then it's going to be extremely difficult for them to make changes themselves. So they have to have somewhere to start. And dev ownership. So the developers have to have this feeling that this thing in production is mine, ours, and that they are responsible for how it works with other applications, and if there's a problem, they need to help out with fixing it. And lastly, building a team. As the company has grown, I've been there for almost 2 years. It was a little over 20 when I joined. It's now about 120. I can't support right now about 50 engineers. So need to start hiring, need to build a team, and what does that mean? So first, metrics and monitoring. I'm gonna have to speed up a little bit. I chose Datadog. Datadog was great. It was very similar to what I did at LinkedIn. The key thing was showing a lead developer in one of the teams, hey, this is what StatsD is. Here's some documentation, go nuts. Now he can then educate the rest of the people on his team and on parallel teams. It doesn't all have to come from me. and then expand access to the monitoring system so that people can write their own alerts. This does mean false positives. Sucks. It just happened last week. You deal with it, you move on. And in the avenue of simplicity, remove the onion systems. SCM builds, some of the teams use SVN, some of the teams use Git. Again, more simplification. Everybody uses Git. We purchased GitHub Enterprise. It's been fantastic. We started using BuildBot. We are in the process of getting rid of it, but it provided reproducible builds of the C++ code. Most of the code is Python, but there is a piece that is C++. So this means that we can have a more predictable thing that we want to deploy. In this case, they're tarballs. The Python code is deployed directly from Git. I am not a fan at all, but I have other problems to fix. And as I mentioned, BuildBot is being replaced with Circle. For infra, all of our changes have to be committed to Git. Having things where people manually change stuff just simply doesn't work. We have very simplified tests. It is easier to expand on tests than to start from scratch. So just having simple tests shows A, that tests are important, and gives a simple framework which others can then expand on. There are testing hosts for every member of the team so they can run their tests. They can run a sample of what they're trying to deploy into production and know that they have at least some reliability that's going to work. Again, more simplification. The release improvements, a lot of this was more process and not so much technical. All the non-prod environments are completely open at this point. It used to be that just like production, there was a single person that would deploy to it. Because he was the only one who knew the whole stack, he was also the only one that could deploy to the staging environments or even the development environments. That was all changed. The developers have complete access. This is not, again, without its issues. Developers will deploy to a stack where it is shared with a couple, and another developer starts screaming, why did this break? You might want to talk to the other guy. He just upgraded. Okay, cool, no problem. Prod releases now during business hours. This makes it possible if there's a problem for people being on hand and not obviously calling somebody, oh, I'm at dinner, I will look at it in 3 hours. Backwards compatibility, one of the things that was a real challenge was saying, hey, you want to make schema changes, they have to be backwards compatible. Again, the developer, one of the lead developers, was really instrumental in making this happen. He was completely on board with this whole process. Tickets in Jira, this helped with communication. Plans in a wiki, again, more communication, again, all process. And then planning meetings. Now, as things got better, we moved to every week instead of every other week. Things have gotten routine, so much so that a smooth release is just standard. We got rid of the planning meetings. What's important to keep in mind is you don't have to plan or change a process for 2 years from now. Fix the current problem with the idea that, hey, you can remove whatever you've just changed later. Slack, feature flags so we can roll things out slower. We use Slack everywhere. More documentation, lots of Jira. Dev ownership. So self-service with GitHub and Circle, root access to all the dev machines, and then decreasing access as we move up the chain, and then access to all the tools. I hired more people. They are assigned to a subset. Or they are assigned to a couple different products. Not having economies of scale is a little bit painful. Meetings, so everybody can kind of touch base. And we also use Kanban. There's a note about sprint reporting. It has to do with how the other teams report. There's still lots left to do. The important one is the last one, and that was more than I could fit on a ton of slides. Lessons, patience. You have to involve the developers. Don't be afraid of failure. Respect the people that came before you. They made some decisions based on something that was true at the time that might be completely false now. Start small and iterate. Again, none of this is rocket science. Names matter. The whole idea of rebranding from AppOps to SRE at LinkedIn helped signify that, hey, we are making a change, and hopefully it's going to be for the better. Then I will skip through a lot of this. Hiring is hard. It's always hard, even at scale. And then lastly, SRE and DevOps are cooperative terms. They are not mutually exclusive. I do get that question a lot. And then one more thing. We are hiring like everybody else. Now, do you have any questions? There's a bunch of contact information here if you have anything else.